I cannot. But now I have 198-3457 State versus Ringo, about which we heard something in the previous argument. You were here, Mr. Martin. Richard D. Martin, Assistant State Public Defender, representing Mr. Ringo. Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abrahamson. Good morning. It pleases the court, I am Richard Martin, and I do represent defendant appellant Andre Wingo. This case is here on a petition to bypass the Court of Appeals. And the issue before the court today is whether the fundamental constitutional right under the Wisconsin Constitution to a 12-person jury can be denied by the operation of a statute which this court has said was unconstitutional, where no objection was lodged in trial. And I submit that the clear answer to the question is no, inasmuch as this court in Hansford made clear that a jury is, and in Wisconsin always has been 12 people. Hansford cited and discussed a long line of cases stretching back almost to statehood, all of which, as this court said, all of which stand for the proposition that a jury is 12 people. And if Hansford was correctly decided, and the state hasn't suggested otherwise as far as the merits of the constitutional analysis, they haven't suggested otherwise either in their briefs or in oral argument earlier today, if it's correct, then Mr. Wingo has never had a jury trial. A jury in Wisconsin is 12 people, and he hasn't had a jury trial. As the court knows, yesterday I sent a letter when I realized that the statute's effective date came after Mr. Wingo was charged, and thus, even if the statute had been constitutional, it shouldn't have been used in his case. This new information may make this case a bit easier to decide, but at the same time, it demonstrates something that I was struggling to find an adequate hypothetical to illustrate. There's one hypothetical in my reply brief where I talk about assuming simply inadequate number of jurors, that they can't impanel enough in the pool, and the judge says we'll go ahead anyway with less than 12, and no one objects. And clearly this court would reverse that in a minute. Let me suggest another. Suppose a trial judge somewhere in Wisconsin didn't know about Hansford, and the defense attorney didn't know about Hansford, and the prosecutor didn't know about Hansford. Would the result be any different? This court would reverse, because this court has said that the statute is unconstitutional. And why should the result be any different in Mr. Wingo's case?
So
but the state's, I'm sorry.
Are you prejudiced? Or why would the, let me start. Two things I want to tell you. One, you advised the court yesterday that this case was, began before the six-person jury came into effect, is that right?
That's correct.
All right. You're going to then argue that on that basis, you had a six-person jury that was no authority for?
Absolutely correct. That makes the requirement of a personal waiver of a jury of less than 12, which is discussed in Cooley and Livingston and a number of cases, Layman, I believe, that makes that requirement even a stronger issue in this case because there simply was no waiver of less than 12. It makes this case itself an easier case for the courts to decide.
Okay. So your position, I want to sort of isolate these two issues because if you argue Hansford, there's nothing really to do with your case as a practical matter, right?
Well, yes and no. And I hate answers like that, but it does and it doesn't. If it weren't for Hansford, Mr. Wingo would have had a 12-person jury. If the statute hadn't been in the collective consciousness of the court system, he would have had a 12-person jury. And so, yes, it does have something to do with my case. If this statute hadn't been passed, he would have had 12 people.
But this statute at Hansford just did not apply as a matter of law.
That's my reading of looking at the Act very carefully. The very last section says its effective date is, it applies to cases commenced on the effective date and thereafter, basically.
Not crimes committed?
No, it does not. It definitely does not say crimes committed. It says cases commenced.
Okay, and this was commenced before that.
That's correct. This was commenced in March 6th of 1996. The statute's effective date was
amended. Yes. All right.
Hey, it's interesting here. You've got a case that took over a year to come to trial. You have a case where six different attorneys were involved, most of whom withdrew through no fault of Mr. Wingo's. They took other jobs, they left the practice of law, they had conflicts of interest. This is all on the record. Which attorney do we point the finger at and say, you should have raised objection? Presumably the one who did the trial. But it illustrates the problem with this issue. You asked me a question about prejudice. The prejudice comes down to the simple declaration that Mr. Wingo still hasn't had his jury trial, and that's what he wants. That when this court decided Hansford, as the Chief Justice said earlier today, implicitly, it was a substantial error. Implicitly, it affected Mr. Hansford's substantial rights. It's the kind of error that this court and the U.S. Supreme Court calls a structural error. It's the kind of error where the difficulty in assessing prejudice in an individual case is not worth the cost because the right is so important.
Is there any way to find for you in this case, and to find for the state in the Heber case?
I wouldn't encourage you to do that, but...
I know you will.
Well, yeah, yes, there is. Purely in the statutory effective date issue, yes, there is.
And then what do? Say the statute does not affect, he's entitled to a 12-person jury?
Correct.
It was waived?
I'm sorry?
Then what do? Say it's waived?
Well, it wasn't waived within the meaning of the word waiver. Waiver means an intentional, voluntary, knowing, waiver of a known right, giving up of a known right. The state has, as it said earlier today, refined its argument between Huebner and Wingo, and they have restyled their waiver argument as a forfeiture argument. But the very case they cite, United States versus Olano from the U.S. Supreme Court, explains rights that could be forfeited are rights that depend upon timely assertion, or else they can be forfeited. Rights that can be waived are a different class of rights, and this court and the statutes and decades of case law says a jury trial right is not a right that you can forfeit.
Well, you know, we're using, and that's my fault, I'm using waiver in two senses. One, you're absolutely right, waiver as to rights. And then there's a second sense in which the cases use the term waiver, and that is if you fail to make a procedural objection, or even a constitutional objection, and you fail to do it at the trial court, you can't bring it up at the Court of Appeals, and that's a Supreme Court. And that's a kind of appellate jurisdictional concept of waiver. It doesn't matter if you knew it or you didn't know it. You can't raise anew an issue that you did not raise below.
But part of that presupposes an imputation of knowledge of what the existing law is. The whole purpose behind the waiver doctrine, as I understand it, is to force litigants to present issues to trial courts. Give trial courts an opportunity to rule on those issues, not sandbag trial courts by building an error for later. So it presupposes some knowledge in the mind of the actors in the trial court before the forfeiture or waiver could occur.
But basically, your strongest argument you're bringing here is this is what the suggestion is basically that some of the law was a 12-person jury. We missed it. Your side missed it.
We all missed it.
We
all missed it.
And therefore, he's entitled to it, and Hansford does not come into this equation.
That's correct.
In a nutshell, that's what you're saying in this letter.
That's correct. That's correct. It was hidden in plain sight. I mean, the criminal complaint was cited in my brief, the date of it. And the effective date of the statute has always been June of 96, so it was right there.
It was there, but the old adage, ignorance of the law is no excuse, does not apply.
To
anyone. That's the question. Because you took a collective blame, the judge, counsel, in fact there were six counsel who collectively did not, but basically fault the trial counsel.
Right, it kind of reminds me of an anecdote Judge Fine has in his book where he talks about a public TV auction where there was I'm going to get real brief. There was an item for sale called a PAML, and everyone assumed that they should know what a PAML was, so they didn't say anything. He checked. The word lamp had been mistransposed. This is the same kind of thing. Everyone assumed that Mr. Wingo should have a six-person jury because the statute applied. It didn't. The significance of Hansford can't be overstated today because what this court said in Hansford was that for over 150 years, the right to a jury trial means the right to 12 people. That's why you've got to see this statute, which existed basically for 2 years before you struck it down, as a blip, just a cipher compared to 150 years, a large handful of cases this court discussed and analyzed. The discussions of the Constitutional Convention, or at least the discussions of people who attended the Constitutional Convention or were part of it, to affirm here, the court would have to basically overrule an unbroken line of decisions which make clear the personal waiver of a jury of less than 12 is required. In finding this statute unconstitutional, this court diligently applied two important principles. One, it presumed the legislative enactments are constitutional, and two, it understood that challengers must prove their unconstitutionality beyond a reasonable doubt. And this court granted the statute its presumption, and the court held Hansford to his high burden, but found that he met it. The court in Hansford rejected the state's substantive arguments completely. So now the state is left with procedural arguments. If there had been a reasonable hypothesis of constitutionality, so to speak, this court would have upheld the statute, but it didn't. I'm really troubled by some of the discussion in the earlier argument about ineffective counsel and what attorneys should challenge and what they shouldn't challenge and who has to let who know. When I heard prior counsel suggest that somehow the bigger institutional actors, the public defender and the Department of Justice, have to let the lawyers out in the field know all this, I thought, well, constitutional right to a jury trial of 12 is 150 years old. When we took oaths to represent our clients zealously and uphold the Constitution. The Constitution is 152 years old. Penicillin is newer than a 12-person jury. I can't imagine a doctor saying, well, gee, I didn't know that I should have used penicillin because Donna Shalala didn't tell me. NIH didn't issue a bulletin. This is fundamental duty of an attorney to represent his client zealously. The question...
Doesn't that argue for issue preservation that this is a new law, it's only on the books for 2 years, and lawyers, unless you're saying, oh no, once it's on the books, that's it, and it should no longer be challenged. In other words, can't have it both ways.
Neither of us can have it both ways. I mean, the state wants to tell you on one hand it was forfeited, on the other hand, you can't really expect the lawyer to do anything about it. I'm troubled by the idea that was, I think, argued for earlier today, that somehow a defense attorney just walks into court, accepts the existing rules, and just puts on a case and doesn't have to challenge anything. It'd be like saying a search warrant was issued by a judge, therefore it must have been okay.
Counsel, you obviously have to make challenges, but you have to pick and choose, right?
Absolutely.
I'm sorry, I can't remember, but there was either in one of these briefs or in a case that indicated if you always have forfeiture or waiver, then defense counsel is just going to have to come in with a stack of stuff. Otherwise you waived it. On the other hand, neither defense counsel nor the state nor the court can deal with that stack of stuff. You pick and choose what you do in a particular case.
Absolutely, and that's why the answer to Justice Prosser's question this morning should have been, when he says which statutes should be challenged, the ones that are unconstitutional. That may sound like a glib answer, but I mean it. This court found the statute unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt, as I keep saying and probably will keep saying. That means it was glaringly wrong. It wasn't just a little wrong, maybe bad policy, maybe questionable. This court said it was glaringly wrong. And it's not too much to ask a trained lawyer. And the irony here is that we're going to somehow excuse a trained lawyer who went to law school and took an oath, excuse his or her failure to challenge the statute, and somehow lay on criminal defendants the sole burden of protecting themselves against the state, the legislature, and their own attorney.
Your position is that this was deficient lawyering.
In light of the Hansford decision, it clearly was.
Okay. So then, even if we accept that, although the trial court did not, and I gather has not done that on the grounds that, although it was clear after Hansford, it wasn't so clear before, and that this would have been a stack of materials. All right. So now the counsel is deficient, and you have to, then it's not your obligation, right, defense counsel's obligation to prove prejudice. Is that right?
Correct. It is. I don't think, but you have to see that in the context of this being a structural error. So what is the prejudice here? The prejudice is one of two things. Either if Mr. Real had said, Judge, I have a constitutional objection to the statute, I would like a 12-person jury. I know there are judges in Milwaukee County who, when that objection was tendered, gave 12-person juries. There were judges who themselves had doubts about the constitutionality of that statute, and rather than risk reversal to save the cost of paying six jurors, they gave the 12-person jury. So if the objection had been tendered, Mr. Wingo would have had what this court recognized in Hansford as a valuable constitutional right, one sufficiently valuable that required a per se reversal without inquiring into the facts of Mr. Hansford's case. Alternatively, if Judge Crawford had rejected the challenge and said, no, I think the statute passes constitutional muster, then the issue would have been preserved, and you or the Court of Appeals would give Mr. Wingo that which Hansford says he's not entitled to, the 12-person jury trial, which is the only jury trial known to Wisconsin law.
It's prejudice per se.
Prejudice per se, exactly right.
We don't have to deal with these cases anymore because it's just prejudice per se.
That's correct.
Whether he asked for 12 or he didn't ask for 12.
Correct. Whether it's 6, 7, 9, 12, anything less than 12, this court has said, has to be personally waived. That kind of leads into the word floodgates wasn't used today, but the issue of how many cases this affects. And one thing that got lost in the discussion, and Ms. Day was correct, that the direct appeal time has run for the lion's share of all misdemeanors, because misdemeanor by definition is a case punishable by a year or less. So there may be a handful of cases that they're still in the pipeline for direct appeal, with very few. But
how
also...
Can I ask
sure.
What were those 974-06 not committed?
I'm sorry?
Does 974, as far as the ability, if there has been the, as you say, prejudice per se, that they cannot use that?
That was exactly my next point.
That's fine.
974-06, by its own terms, requires a defendant to be in custody under the sentence. And that is the answer to the other aspect of floodgates. The number of people who will be in custody still under a 90-day misdemeanor sentence, a six-month misdemeanor sentence, even a year misdemeanor sentence, is still going to be a relevant handful. There again, there may be some people who had imposed state sentences, but we're talking about large handfuls, not hundreds and thousands in any event.
Mr. Martin, what about the situation involving convictions for operating while under the influence of an intoxicant, where the issue is this a second or third or fourth conviction? My understanding is that in many of those situations where the claim is, no, Judge, this really is not the second conviction or the third conviction, there can be a collateral attack on the earlier conviction. Wouldn't that collateral attack be based on Hansford in many situations? And wouldn't that be a large number of cases that would then be affected?
Well, this court, if a case involving collateral attack comes to this court would have, it is a different question that's presented by this case and by Ms. Day's case. And certainly collateral attacks can be brought, but I don't think the nature of the collateral attacks that's often brought in drunk driving cases is of this sort, and I'm not quite focusing on the...
Well, I can imagine situations where a trial judge is sitting in Dane County, that judge has traffic jurisdiction, and the case comes before him or her, the claim is, no, Judge, this really is not a criminal charge, because of the fact that last time around there was not a 12-person jury. Or, Judge, this is a situation where we've got to go beyond the, I think it's now 10 years, is it not, that you go back? Anyway, Judge, because of the fact that there was not a 12-person jury, this earlier conviction can't be counted. I can see all kinds of arguments being made. Am I wrong in that regard?
No, you're not wrong, but I think that those attacks are mounted when there is a continuing consequence of the first conviction or the second conviction or the third. And what I'm saying is that I think in the lion's share, not clearly not all, but in the lion's share of misdemeanors, that's not going to be the case. someone goes to jail for 6 months for battery, for 2 months for retail theft. As Ms. Day is correct, those people have served their sentences for the most part.
I'm just following up on that question. We're talking, brought up about the handful of cases. It will be, depending upon how this court goes, it will be well known that this is now the law, and the collateral effect in the OWI situation would seem to me to be very realistic. It would be one that certainly among defense counsel, people that are specialized or are in this field, would say, yes, this is something that we naturally would bring, particularly if it's a second, third, or fourth time.
Well, one would have thought that the debate in the legislature about whether to enact this statute and the constitutional objections that were raised then, even before the legislature passed the statute, would have been well known. One would have thought the constitutional challenges to the statute that were brought from its inception, from its enactment, until Hansford, would have been well known. Unfortunately, what's happened is we found that these things aren't always well known, and we have one defense attorney telling you it's not fair to expect them to know all this stuff that's happening out there in the courts.
Counsel, am I correct that you've got direct
or an extraordinary writ of some sort, which I think wouldn't be applicable here.
Because I'm following up on Justice Cook's question, bread and butter issue of, is this really your defense, or is this really sort of your defense argument? No, Judge, no, the other conviction was valid. Do all collateral attacks then have to be 97406 while
you focused on the flaw or the weakness in my answer that I was aware of as I was giving it, which is I'm not sure what the vehicle is by which some of these collateral attacks are brought against drunk driving convictions. I don't handle any first offense drunk drivings, and rarely see it in the second and third in the few cases I get. So I'm not sure, and that's why I sort of fudged by talking about a continuing consequence, because I'm frankly not sure what the vehicle is. But I can tell you under 97406, in the criminal context, it requires custody. I think that in a drunk driving case, unlike a six-month misdemeanor sentence, unlike a nine-month misdemeanor sentence, the continuing consequences of the conviction extend far beyond a year. You've got a revocation of license, you've got suspension, you've got all sorts of other consequences which are continuing. That's what leads me to believe there must be a vehicle to get in to challenge those, perhaps first administratively and then in the courts, and I don't know what the answer is. In a criminal traffic case? Well, there's a different procedure whereby one has to pay an additional fee because it's a civil case. We're talking about the constitutional right to a jury trial in a criminal case, which is what Hansford limited itself to. In fact, it specifically drew a distinction between Article 1, Section 5 of the Constitution and Article 1, Section 7 of the Constitution, and said it was only concerned with the criminal jury trial right, and that was 12. There is certainly a civil jury trial right to 12, but you have to pay a fee. The non-criminal jury trials are a whole different animal. You don't need a unanimous verdict. All right? Life is unfair sometimes. I mean, it's just the fact that in civil cases, I suppose an indigent could ask a judge to remit the fees, but there's no right to counsel. I mean, in a civil traffic case, there's no right to counsel. If you're indigent, you're out of luck. As far as getting a lawyer to.
Well, the historic record you point to starts with the Normal versus Wright case, and that held unconstitutional statute that applies to six-member jury in a civil case.
Right. And our statute allows for a 12-person jury in a civil case to this day. But it imposes an additional requirement on civil litigants, which I believe is to pay an additional fee above and beyond what you have to pay for a six-person jury. And as I was saying, the jury trial right itself is so different in civil cases. The burden of proof is different. There's no unanimity requirement. There is no right to counsel in a civil case. So so it's just a whole different sort of trial. But the right is there. I mean, any civil litigant can come into court and say, Judge, I've got a constitutional right under Hansford and Hansford's line of cases going back to Normal, and I want my 12-person jury. It would be an interesting question whether a civil litigant could say, Judge, I can't afford the jury fee. Would you remit it? Would you forgive it? And that's just, I mean, that comes up in cases where we find, in another context, when the public defender's office finds people don't, well, this court, I think, addressed it in Cook versus Cook, whether there's a right to counsel in a civil case. I think it was a divorce case. And I think the court said there's a limited right, and I think the court said that the judge has to appoint an attorney at county expense when there is that right. I think that's the answer. And so there might be an analogous answer in a jury trial.
Well, but
if
I'm listening to Justice Cross's question and your response, I say to you, look, under Section 5 of the Declaration of Rights and under Section 7 of the Declaration of Rights, they both say you're entitled to jury trial. One says trial by jury remains inviolate. The other one says your right to an impartial jury of a county or district where the crime was committed. So now you know that Section 7 says you can't do anything more than a 12-person jury by constitution. Makes me think that at least under 5, if it can be, it should be a 12-person. Now, not the proviso under 5, it says, but a jury trial may be waived by the parties in all cases prescribed by manner of law. Well, maybe we could waive the whole jury trial, but what is it, can you waive the 12-person jury trial? And can you do it on money? So, after I said all that, I've got a little concern about all this legislation. So, but following through with just processes, if I've got a concern under your argument, I have to now challenge that in a civil case. Otherwise, I have a deficient performance, according to your analysis.
Well, I don't handle civil cases, but the right is there in the Constitution to a jury trial. But the whole procedure whereby one even invokes the right to a jury trial in a civil case, you have to demand it. We have a statute in a criminal case that is a presumption.
Maybe all that's wrong. All that statute may be just wrong.
Well, the statute
may be unconstitutional.
Which one? The civil one or the criminal?
The one.
Well, I'm not authorized by my agency to represent civil litigants and will not start doing that today.
I understand that, but your argument here is that counsel should have known. And I'm just saying to you that if counsel should have known at 7, maybe counsel should know at 5, and if pushing this argument that counsel should have known, a lot of these counsels should know if you have the foresight to think it through.
Sure. I mean, I can't disagree with that, but the whole right to a jury trial in a civil case is not self-perpetuating. It has to be demanded, whereas in a criminal case, there's a presumption backed up by lots of case law that it's a fundamental right that can only be waived personally by the defendant. I see my red lights on.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Weber, representing the State Attorney General.
Chief Justice, members of the court, good morning. I'd like to begin with a residual point from the previous argument, the Huebner argument, with discussion of whether a criminal defendant or what circumstances under which a criminal defendant would prefer a 6-person jury. I can conceive of at least 4 legitimate circumstances where a defendant might prefer a 6-person rather than a 12-person jury. The first set of circumstances, if a defendant believes that he or she has a very strong case and is looking forward to acquittal and doesn't want to run the risk that a 12-person jury might include one person who would support conviction. The larger the number of jurors, the larger the chance that one would be out of step would support conviction and thereby hang the jury. So if a defendant comes in with a particularly strong case, there may be a preference for trial by a jury of 6. The second set of circumstances. In situations involving hot-button trials, situations where there's a lot of public outrage against a particular defendant, where there's a lot of pretrial publicity, it may be easier for a defendant to find an unbiased jury of six rather than a jury of 12, particularly in a smaller community where publicity tends to be very pervasive. The third justification, a defendant might reasonably conclude that a lone juror in a panel of six holding out for the defendant, holding out for acquittal, would be more capable of sticking to his or her guns against five voting for conviction rather than 11. The fourth set of circumstances touches on what Mr. Martin and Justice Prosser were discussing in the context of civil cases. A defendant's experience or a defense attorney's experience with a six-person civil jury might persuade the defense that a six-person jury is more likely to create a favorable group dynamic when the issues are presented to the court.
Counsel, that sounds great. It sounds very rational and articulate. But let's say I'm a criminal defendant, and I say, look, in a jury of six, I gotta shake one. Get a hung jury. With the 12 people, I gotta shake one. That seems to me that I got twice the odds of shaking one with 12 than with six. I'd go for that. Now, that may not be rational, that may not be articulate, but pretty elementary arithmetic.
It's also, at least in the context of prejudice as we've been discussing it today, it's also inconsistent with the framework that this court has to follow. We employ juries not to give defendants a better chance at hanging up the jury by persuading one. We have jury trials to impose the will of society in between a prosecutor who's looking to jack up a particular defendant unfairly or a judge who's not applying the law or who's behaving in a biased or eccentric manner. That's Duncan versus Louisiana. Those purposes are amply served when trial is to a jury of six as opposed to trial to a jury of 12. We have that same imposition of society in between the prosecutor and the defendant or the judge and the defendant.
I know the answer. Is the prejudice that you're focusing here, the prejudice, the outcome of the jury, would it be substantially different? Or is the prejudice that the defendant is deprived of his right to choose?
Got a real good answer to that up until yesterday morning. I think the framework...
What happened yesterday?
Oh, I got Rich's love letter.
Okay.
I think the analytical framework that we have to follow here is Strickland, and that's by Mr. Wingo's choice in raising a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel.
If you didn't have to follow ineffective assistance of counsel, but it was straight statutory, then what's the answer?
Then I still think, for purposes of the forfeiture analysis that I've offered in this case, we have to focus less on the invocation of the right to trial by jury than on the remedy, the impact that the forfeiture has on the remedy that the defendant asks for when he comes into court. Having forfeited, having stayed silent, having failed to object to the trial by six, you know, this court, in this context, is being called upon to decide whether a judgment already rendered has to be set aside because of an alleged error to which no one objected.
You agree it's an error.
I'm sorry?
You agree it was an error here?
Normally the night before an oral argument, I try and relax. I didn't have that option last night. I am inclined, and Mr. Martin may speak to this in his rebuttal, I'm inclined to think that the deficient performance picture in his case has changed pretty remarkably with the information that has been brought forward. Before we were talking about a claim of deficient performance based on a failure to object, and I was comfortable making the argument that a reasonable representation under prevailing professional norms might lead someone to not object to the constitutionality of a statute in the state circuit court. As I understand the impact of this new information relative to Mr. Wingo, I see potentially a second line of analysis for deficient performance, a failure to accurately identify the controlling law. And at this stage, while I might well be able to find cases out there that would stand for the proposition that it isn't deficient performance, I haven't had an opportunity to do that.
How about State versus Erickson? Can't you argue that? If I fall in that case, everyone made a mistake, judge, prosecutor, defense attorney, got the wrong number of jurors in terms of what was the correct number under the law of peremptory strikes. All made the same mistake, much like it. All made a mistake of clear law. And much like here, all made a mistake of what should be clear law. Why doesn't your argument just slip into Erickson?
As I understand Erickson, the focus in that case was on the prejudice analysis. I don't think that the court... we're challenging Ramos every week. I'm trying to remember.
That was written to dodge the Ramos. No, not true.
Certainly, I think the forfeiture analysis offered by the state survives the factual information that was provided by counsel pertaining to Wingo. And this case factually, both in deficient performance and prejudice analysis, appears much closer to Erickson than any of the other cases that the defense relies upon. Frankly, the state is more interested in the Erickson analysis as it pertains to prejudice, as that term is used in Strickland. As I understand Erickson, it stands for the proposition that speculation as to the possible effect of an error, if error, isn't enough. In Erickson, the question was whether the court was going to try and parse out any kind of prejudice that may have resulted if each side had been given additional peremptory challenges. And the court flat out said, we're not going to speculate. It is the defendant's burden in a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel to present actual prejudice, evidence of actual prejudice. And in Erickson, the defendant couldn't do it. And the court said Strickland means what it says. He hasn't shown prejudice. He's not entitled to relief on a claim of ineffective assistance. Seems to me that that's what we have here.
But aren't you, if you take that position, do you concede that it's nigh on impossible for the defendant to show prejudice?
It is very, very difficult for the defendant to show prejudice. Absolutely.
Is that the same as nigh on to impossible?
Only you know for sure. It would be very difficult. It would be very difficult for a defendant to show prejudice, and that is not a bad thing, because completely absent from the discourse in these two cases is any kind of qualitative proof that a jury of six is incapable of rendering a fair verdict, as opposed to a jury of 12. Now, there's lots of social sciences literature out there that talks about the improved opportunity of a defendant to hang a jury, that talks about how a group dynamic is different in a jury of six than a jury of 12. But in terms of a fundamental, qualitative, demonstrable inability of a jury of six to render a fair verdict, Mr. Wingo has to lose under Strickland. I mean, Williams has said we don't have a qualitative difference in the ability of a jury of six to render a fair verdict. And if we're talking claims of ineffective assistance of counsel, I think that this court is probably bound by the analysis in Williams and has to say we have no prejudice for purposes of Strickland.
Well,
different than if it were a direct appeal.
I'm sorry?
That would be different than a direct appeal, just showing error.
Our position would be that Hansford, at least, certainly does not stand for the proposition that there is a qualitative difference in the decision-making ability of a jury of six as opposed to a jury of 12. As I said in the earlier argument, I understood the decision in Hansford to be grounded in the historical fact that in Wisconsin, jury trials have historically been trials by 12 rather than by six. I don't read Hansford as saying that there is a qualitative difference. I also, frankly, don't understand the litigants in Wingo and in Huebner as making a case for the proposition that a jury of six is incapable, structurally incapable, of rendering a fair and impartial verdict within the context of a Strickland prejudice analysis. I think they have to do that in order to prevail. At least Mr. Wingo has to do that in order to prevail.
That goes back to Justice Bradley's question, what do you mean by prejudice? That the outcome of the jury would be different, and that's what you are arguing, and that was your answer to Strickland, or that you're deprived of the right to choose, and that was the prejudice.
I think we have to look to the language of Strickland based on the defendant's choice to claim here, and that is prejudice in terms of the fairness of the proceeding that was ultimately had. And again, if we had a basis to say that the U.S. Supreme Court is telling us that juries of six are qualitatively inferior to juries of 12, that you can't get a fair trial within the meaning of Strickland if you're using a jury of six, then we'd have a better argument for prejudice on Mr. Wingo's part. We don't have that.
But if we just apply the Strickland analysis and find, as you argue, no prejudice, the conviction can stand. You basically tried somebody under a law that convicted at the time he was charged.
If that's the case, if this court doesn't accept the forfeiture analysis.
Let's talk about that for a minute. But do you agree that the difference between a waiver and a forfeiture is that a forfeiture can be found when you're talking about a right which requires a timely assertion for exercise?
You can forfeit a fundamental constitutional right, a right that has to be personally waived. If you look at Justice Scalia's analysis in Freytag versus CIR, which is cited in the state's brief, that involves, I believe, a right that has to be personally waived. The difference between waiver and forfeiture is that waiver is a subset of forfeiture. You can forfeit a right by waiving it. Some rights to be waived require a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver. But a constitutional right, whether it's a state or a federal constitutional right, can be forfeited by non-assertion. And our position in this litigation has been that that's what happened here. Now, I am still, frankly, trying to put together the impact of the information that we got yesterday as to the factual posture of this case. And I'm still doing the crunching in my mind on that. But I don't think that our forfeiture analysis has to fail because of that disclosure.
Counsel, my sense is, given these high burdens, high tests to show prejudice, that the state's position in these cases, is stronger under ineffective assistance of counsel. Because to show prejudice, you have to show a probability sufficient to undermine confidence in the outcome, that the result of the trial would have been different. And that's the test that I use the phrase nigh on impossible. So, you've got a lot going for you as a state if you can embrace that test, because it's awfully hard for the defendant to meet. But if you don't have the protection of that very stringent prejudice test in Strickland,
where do you go?
You go to the forfeiture analysis, which suggests that in situations where a defendant fails to assert a constitutional right, a statutory
and
right, whatever.
And if this court doesn't accept the forfeiture analysis, but says it's a waiver, and then not knowing intelligent behavior, is there any place else that you can go, or are you out? I mean,
no.
All of your case resting on this was a forfeiture rather than a waiver.
It would make the state's position much more difficult. Where this court would go, I would hope, if they are not willing to adopt the forfeiture analysis, is I still think the court needs to consider whether there is that qualitative difference in a judgment rendered by a jury of six as opposed to a jury of 12, bearing in mind that we're talking about the remedy. Okay? If two attorneys in criminal litigation, came to a judge and said, we want to have a trial by a jury of eight, the judge would be bound to say, no, I need a personal waiver. I need a personal waiver from your client. We're talking, in this case at least, at the remedy side. We've already had a trial. We've had a trial in which there's no error, but for the claimed error based on the jury size. I think this court would have to decide for purposes of that analysis, is the trial by a jury of six below a qualitative threshold, a threshold of reliability such that we want to overturn an otherwise valid judgment simply because the defendant failed to assert a right to trial by 12. Now, that may be a step that the court is not willing to take, but since Hansford doesn't discuss in any great detail qualitative distinctions between juries of six and juries of 12 insofar as decision-making is concerned, this court may want to take the opportunity to do that if it gets to that point in the analysis in Wingo. Between the two arguments, I've said pretty much...
Also, I have a question.
If this court is inclined to view that information in the context of the ineffective assistance of counsel argument, and if it is inclined to find that counsel is ineffective under the circumstances as revised by that information, I want an opportunity to file briefs. This court may not have to get to that point in deciding the case. But
why not? Why won't it get to that point?
I understood the drift of the argument to be suggesting that it may not even rise to the level of ineffectiveness if you decide that a jury is a jury of 12 under any set of circumstances. If you get to that point, you may be able to avoid the ineffectiveness analysis. I'm sorry. I've been trying to process this information now.
That would be under Hansford.
That would be under Hansford.
Get a jury trial in effectiveness. So it's per se, whatever you want to call it. Okay. Thank you.
I think.
Sorry, just a question.
Where did you win? What would be the strategy?
I think that the law would still be that a waiver of your right to jury would have to be personal, knowing, voluntary, intelligent. I think that is the bottom line holding of Cooley, and I see that as being ineffective. If this court adopts the state's forfeiture analysis,
it will put litigants on notice that objections need to be made with specific specificity to preserve issues for review. I don't think that would change that aspect of the rule. I thank the court.
Thank you. Counsel, Mr. Morrison.
I have 3 points I want to make quickly, but before I do, I want to respond to the Strickland issue, and I don't want to get too far into the swamp so that I can't get out and make my 3 points, but the discussion of prejudice in the context of Strickland is assuming, I think, is thinking in a classical trial performance context, whether the verdict was unjust, whether there's a reasonable possibility that an innocent person was convicted. But this court said long before Strickland, I think at least as early as State versus Rock, which I think is around 92 was second, that ineffective counsel can be grounds to withdraw a guilty plea. Now the point of that is, and the reason for that is not necessarily that a person pled guilty and they weren't guilty, but that they waived an important bundle of constitutional rights without an attorney performing as an attorney should perform. And so if the attorney was ineffective and didn't provide adequate advice to his client, and it can be shown in the trial court proceeding, a mock hearing, that the defendant would not have pled guilty but for the attorney's ineffectiveness, then the plea must be allowed to be withdrawn. So the focus there is, as I think Justice Bradley said, whether you're making a knowing choice, whether the choice to waive the right is knowing and intelligent because of your attorney's advice or lack thereof. So I like to shift the focus from whether I can show prejudice in this case, certainly Mr. Hansford didn't have to whether my client knowingly waived what this court has already said, what we talked about today is an important constitutional right. The 3 points I want to make are these. One, the whole idea, the notion that this is a new rule, that Hansford is a new rule, is just flat wrong. This whole retroactivity discussion is unnecessary. The old rule, which has always been the rule for 152 years now, is a 12-person jury. The new rule was the statute. The new rule is the rogue here, not the Constitution. So the idea that we have to engage in these kind of complex retroactivity discussions is wrong. But even if there is a new rule retroactivity issue, the state has waived their Stovall versus Deno claims long ago in their brief. This court and the Court of Appeals repeatedly says claims not advanced in your brief are deemed waived. The points are deemed conceded. So the state has committed itself before today to a position that retroactivity simply isn't an issue in this case. And three, I want to, as forcefully as I can, take exception to the notion that was advanced in the day oral argument that attorneys didn't raise this issue around the state, that it's just not fair to expect them to do so because they just weren't doing it. It's just not true. First of all, obviously, Mr. Hansford's attorney raised the issue. Secondly, there are a significant number of cases in the wake of Hansford where trial courts reversed themselves, vacated convictions after Hansford because they read Hansford and saw that they hadn't, that there had been a preserved objection and a post-conviction motion was brought. Third, there are unpublished Court of Appeals decisions, many of them, and if you want them, I can get them for you. I've got most of them. Lois or Westlaw will give them to you, where the Court of Appeals, in the wake of Hansford, reversed preserved issues. So there are literally probably dozens of cases where convictions have been reversed either in the trial court via post-conviction motion or in the Court of Appeals in unpublished decision, and that doesn't even take into account the cases where, and I know this happened in Milwaukee repeatedly, where the defense attorney raised the issue and the response was, all right, I'll give you 12 jurors. So those people, those attorneys raised it. So it's just simply not true historically to say no one was raising this, no one knew. A lot of people knew, a lot of people were raising it.
Counsel, do you feel there's a need to file further briefs as a result of
Well, my instinct is I don't, because I think this takes this, and this is why I was so disturbed when I found this information and felt an ethical duty to bring it to the court's attention as fast as I could. It does change the posture of the case, and it takes it arguably outside of Hansford and the statute entirely, and then it brings us back to, as Justice Prosser hinted, Cooley, Livingston, Krieger, Moore, et cetera, cases where this court and the Court of Appeals have repeatedly said the record must contain evidence of a knowing and voluntary waiver of a jury less than 12. And the court I always get creepier and more confused. There was one case where the court, this court sent a case back for post-conviction hearing and then subsequently said, this procedure we've undertaken is not desirable. We're not going to do it anymore. If the record doesn't contain an adequate waiver, the remedy is a new trial without further proceedings. So I think in a strictly legal analysis under this court's case law in the Court of Appeals, no, you could reverse without any more briefs. But I also agree with Mr. Posner-Weber that if you're inclined to take a few more steps into the ineffective counsel area, which I think is really, although I raised the issue because I have to deal with this forfeiture slash waiver argument, I really think that is somewhat of a diversion from the central issue, which I want to keep coming back to, that the jury is 12 people.
The jury is what?
12 people.
Thank you.
12 angry men and women.
Not angry. Thank you, both counsel. That ends our hearing. The court's in recess till 1:40.